We are going to talk about David Livingstone, probably one that we're a little more familiar with. Some of these, I've gotten some blank stares when I've introduced the hero of the faith, but this is probably one that we at least have a little bit of frame of reference for. Anybody want to take a shot? How do we know David Livingstone? What do we associate with him? Dr. Livingstone, I presume. Good. So yeah, we'll get to some of the things that are sort of the things we commonly know about him, but I think begin to explore some other aspects of his life that I think are really, really very notable. Livingstone was born to a poor family in Scotland. Matter of fact, he was put to work in the cotton factories at the age of 10, often working 12 to 14 hour days. But he grew up in a very pious family. His father, particularly, was very committed to the faith, was very involved in his church, taught Sunday school faithfully, and really encouraged young David to pursue theological education. Had aspirations for him to be in ministry in some way, which Livingstone did. David pursued theological training, but he also had a bent for science and for exploration. And so he convinced his father that medical training could also be useful wherever God might lead him, right? So he pursued medical training. That ended up leading him to London. And it was in London that he heard a man by the name of, here's Livingstone, a portrait of Livingstone. But it was in London that he heard Dr. Robert Moffat, who was a noted missionary from South Africa. And Moffat made a statement that just kind of lodged in David Livingstone's mind. Moffat said, I had sometimes seen in the morning sun the smoke of a thousand villages where no missionary had ever been. They had this scene of Africa and the untapped masses of Africa that no one had ever reached with the gospel of Jesus. The smoke of a thousand villages as he looked out over the valley, right? And Livingstone was an adventurer. He was always looking for new frontiers, and this just captured his heart and resonated with him. And so he began to put things in motion to go to Africa. So that's where his story will primarily take place, and how he initially was involved in missionary activity. So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. It was 1857 when Livingstone then returned from Africa back to Britain, and he was, I'm going to call him a rock star, just from the standpoint that he was wildly popular. And it was just this sort of mystery about Africa, right? I mean, you didn't have National Geographic Channel or Discovery Channel or, you know, the internet to be able to sort of explore these unreached places. And all the continents had been explored. Columbus had already done his thing, right? But now there was like the interior of Africa. I mean, some of these places were like the next frontiers. And so when he came back to speak in Britain after a 12-year stint in Africa, he was speaking to a packed house. One particular occasion at Cambridge University. And people just had all sorts of questions. Their imagination was stirred. You know, had he really escaped the jaws of a lion? And in fact, he did. Here's a sculpture that's back in his homeland of Scotland that sort of captures this scene. But he was in a village, and this lion had sort of been terrorizing the village. And so Livingstone went out with his gun and looking to find the lion, and the lion found him. He shot the lion, but before the lion died, the lion sunk its teeth into his arm, and he has these 11 really pronounced puncture wounds, and his arm was never the same after that. He could never raise it above his shoulder. So he sort of had this actual encounter with a lion in the jungles of Africa. He had survived, you know, the various encounters with some of the cannibal tribes in Africa's interior. He had had over 30 bouts with various forms of tropical illnesses. He was kind of this bigger than life figure. Of course, he was not, again, tweeting about his whereabouts or posting Instagram photos, right? Years without hearing from him, and they didn't even know if he was alive at different times, you know. And then he would surface, and he'd have all these stories. One of those accomplishments in the early years was that he traversed Africa on foot. I think I had this slide here, kind of there's southern Africa, but he crossed it from the Atlantic side to the Indian Ocean side. It took him 3 years to accomplish that. He'd surface after these expeditions, and that just sort of contributed to the legend. The legend grew. Matter of fact, the quote that Wendy just cited there, Dr. Livingston, I presume, right? This is the famous quote. He had been gone for 6 years. Henry Stanley was sent out to find him and finds him in the interior of Africa and says, as he encounters the only white person and within hundreds of miles, Dr. Livingston, I presume, right? So, again, all these things just kind of caused the legend to grow. He was not only a missionary, but a man of great learning and discovery, and had made contributions in science and medicine. He recorded and described the deadly effects of the tsetse fly and the reality of nearly constant bouts of malaria forced him to experiment with various cures. He was one of the first to identify quinine as an effective prophylactic against malaria. So, and that's just, those are just tips of the iceberg. I mean, he was charting rivers, right? I mean, he's exploring uncharted wildernesses, finding creatures that nobody had, you know, that weren't in any of the encyclopedias, you know. So really a remarkable individual. But he was controversial. And not without significant flaws, and I don't want to mask over those. He would actually marry Dr. Robert Moffat's daughter. I mean, that was kind of, Moffat was his inspiration, was his mentor, and really his boss there on the mission compounds in South Africa. And so it was apparently meant to be. He would marry Robert Moffat's daughter, whose name was Mary, and they would go on to have 6 children. But needless to say, their marriage was complicated. At one point, David and Mary would be separated for 4 years. The children would grow up in large part without their father, something that Livingston would ultimately regret. In fact, he had such a singular focus that he even drew criticism from his missionary in-laws, right? There's some classic correspondence from Dr. Robert Moffat, who let Livingston know in no uncertain terms that he was out of line in terms of sort of his just driven focus at the expense of his family. But his missionary activity also drew certain criticism. One commentator described it this way. On those early journeys, Livingston's interpersonal quirks were already apparent. He had the singular inability to get along with other Westerners. He fought with missionaries, fellow explorers, assistants, and later his brother Charles. He held grudges for years. He had the temperament of a book-reading loner, emotionally inarticulate except when he exploded with Scottish rage. He held little patience for the attitudes of missionaries with miserably contracted minds who had absorbed the colonial mentality regarding the natives. When Livingston spoke out against racial intolerance, white Afrikaners tried to drive him out. burning his station and stealing his animals. So he's kind of a lightning rod among missionaries, and he was really notable for his treatment of the Africans, which again got him in trouble with some of the other Afrikaners there in South Africa. Livingston left his first two missionary posts over disagreements, and really even more so out of a persistent desire to move to the regions beyond. That was his terminology. He was frustrated that so many of the missionaries remained cloistered in the sparsely populated Cape Colony in South Africa. That's down here at the lower edge. That's kind of the main port. That's the landing spot where these missionaries were coming, and there was a strong compound there. But there weren't many people there. And it just frustrated Livingston that they weren't pushing in to the interior of Africa and taking on these uncharted territories with the gospel. Things became so strained with the mission agency, with the London Missionary Society, that they dropped him. They cut his funding and hoped that would be a way of sort of reeling him back in a little bit. But they really essentially felt that that his achievements, his activities, were not really in line with the calling of a missionary. This was one of the things that was sort of at the crux of it. But the London Missionary Society made really sweeping decisions to discontinue their work in such remote and difficult locations. And this just made Livingston so mad. Like, you're shying away from the hard places, right? But they said, no, Livingston, you're actually doing more of the work here of an explorer. I mean, you're more of a Christopher Columbus, right, than an Apostle Paul. And so there were some valid critiques that were going back and forth here. But during the same time, Livingston received an offer of funding from the Royal Geographic Society. So here's this sort of exploratory group, scientific group, that said, we would love to have you be our figurehead, right? You're bigger than life right now in Britain. We'd love for you to bring attention to some of these uncharted territories. And so kind of shocked everybody, but he accepted that offer and saw an opportunity to kind of continue on with his work. Although, again, it would be primarily as an explorer and a scientist rather than as a missionary. And many felt that he was abandoning the faith. He even, as you might well imagine, experienced resistance from his own family and his father-in-law, Dr. Robert Moffat, right? That he was really bailing on gospel ministry. And it was true that Livingston's exploratory journey across Africa had little to do with evangelism. His effectiveness as a missionary was somewhat suspect. There were few converts. Chief Sekele, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, but he was the first significant convert, but he relapsed back into traditional superstitious African practices after a very short time. And so there wasn't a lot to show in terms of gospel inroads, but Livingston believed that his work was crucial for opening up Africa to the gospel. That the roads, literally and figuratively, that he was carving out into the interior would be what would ultimately allow the gospel to penetrate the continent. But the London Missionary Society did not concur. They wanted numbers, not long-term strategies, right? So, again, legitimate tensions on both sides of that. Livingston also at this time had another passion that was developing, and that was the plight of the slave trade. Now, to put it in perspective, it had been 30 years since William Wilberforce, had succeeded in ending the transatlantic slave trade. It was a major milestone. So slavery was there was no more trading of slaves in Europe, in England. But the slave trade was still very strong. The Portuguese, some various Arab groups were very involved in trading African slaves, and Livingston witnessed these atrocities on a daily basis, and it troubled him deeply. And he again believed that many of his actions and exploration could help Africans leverage their natural resources to be able to engage in trade, and that ultimately slavery could be overcome. Up to this point, slavery was the economic commodity of Africa. And he felt if he could help them tap their many natural resources, that that could be a way of diffusing the slave trade. So this, again, was a growing passion for him. He said this about that. Well, here's his engagement with Dr. Livingston, I presume. Here's a clip of his wife and some of his children. He said this about the slaves. No one can estimate the amount of God-pleasing good that will be done if, by divine favor, this awful slave trade, into the midst of which I have come, be abolished. This will be something. This will be something to have lived for. Later in his life, he gave himself to finding the source of the Nile River. This was another one of the Royal Geographic Society's assignments for him, and an area of passion. But at least, and there's questions about where was David Livingstone's heart? Where was his priority? But he said this even about the Nile venture. He said, "The Nile sources are valuable only as a means of opening my mouth with power among men. It is this power with which I hope to remedy an immense evil." In other words, he was seeing this Nile episode endeavor as an opportunity to draw attention to the plight of the slaves. In fact, I commend to you Jay Milbrandt's biography, 2014 biography, The Daring Heart of David Livingstone. The subtitle, Exile, African Slavery, and the Publicity Stunt That Saved Millions. The publicity stunt that saved millions was the search for the Nile, the source of the Nile River. And again, in his own estimation, he said, I'm doing all of this to draw attention to the plight of these slaves. So that was, a growing passion throughout his life. Livingston died from malaria in 1873, malaria and dysentery, at the age of 60. He died in Zambia, in Central Africa. His loyal servants, get this, kids, his loyal servants removed his heart and buried it in Zambia. This marker marks the spot there in that village. They planted it by a large tree that isn't there anymore, but this memorial was constructed. And then they took his body, these same servants, they took his body back to the coast, a 1,000-mile journey that took 63 days in the African sun, where it would then be transported back to Britain. And the text I saw said it laid in state in Britain for at Westminster Abbey, if I recall. Crazy. A year after his death, Parliament succeeded in ending the East African slave trade. And so Livingston was recognized as a national hero in Africa following his death. And again, I would commend Milbrandt's biography, just not just the content, it's very well written. It was one of the it was a page turner for me when I read it a couple years ago. So it's a good one. And as we close, I want to relate actually a story here that Milbrandt uses to close his biography. So this is after Livingston's death, like 4 years after Livingston's death. In August of Kirk's 1877 declaration, an African messenger arrived at the door of the small square house where Chauncey Maples stayed. 25-year-old Chauncey Maples had traveled to the African interior from Britain as a new representative of the university's mission to Central Africa. He came to establish villages, clinics, and schools for freed slaves in a land now free of slavery. Maples had only arrived on the mainland via Zanzibar within the past year. He had traced the Rovuma River to the UMCA's recently reestablished post near Lake Nyasa, where he found himself in a town known as Mataka's Village. The messenger told Maples of a village elder who insisted on seeing him. The elder had met a white man in old days, an Englishman, if at all like he wanted to make Maples' acquaintance. Maples stepped out of the small house and onto the sun-baked, reddish clay streets. He made his way to the house of the old man, passing through the town's sprawling gardens and beds of English peas. Here, in Mataka's village, in 1866, Livingston had spent a fortnight on his last journey. Livingston died, perhaps believing he had failed in every respect, yet in the few short years after his death, everything Livingston had worked for had come to fruition. Maples, a young English missionary building a colony in Central Africa to support freed slaves, embodied all of Livingston's dreams. At the door to the house, the old man called Maples inside and stepped forward to welcome him. In dignified speech, he told of the white man who had visited Mataka's village 10 years before. This is what he said: a white man who treated black men as his brothers, and whose memory would be cherished all along the Rovuma Valley after we were all dead and gone. A short man with a bushy mustache and a keen, piercing eye, whose words were always gentle and whose manners were always kind, at least to Africans. Whom as a leader it was a privilege to follow, and who knew the way to the hearts of all men. Then the old man pointed to a coat hanging behind him. Ragged and deteriorating, the trappings of English tailoring were recognizable to Maples. The man treasured the coat, having kept it for the past decade in memory of the giver. He had parted with it for no one, for no offer. The old man removed the coat from the wall and carefully cradled it. Extending his arms, he presented Livingston's coat to Maples. "As one of Livingston's brothers," he said. So a few lessons as we think about Livingston's life. Number one, following Jesus is a high and holy calling. Livingston was quick when he would speak. People would talk about the great sacrifices that he made. And he was quick to push back. He said, "It is something to be a follower, however feeble, in the wake of a great teacher and only model missionary that ever appeared among men." He saw it to be a great privilege. He said, "Can that be called a sacrifice which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? Is that a sacrifice which brings its own blessed reward and healthful activity, the consciousness of doing good, peace of mind, and a bright hope of a glorious destiny hereafter? Away with the word in such a view and with such a thought. Let's not talk of sacrifice." Number two, social justice is an expression of the gospel. This is one I've long struggled with. And there are periods of time, particularly if we think even about American history, where the gospel has been hijacked by a social agenda. Okay? You know what I'm talking about there? In other words, we work on some social endeavor, we work for civil rights, but if we're not careful, the gospel gets left behind. We lose our mission, right? So with that being said, I think it should be noted that the gospel should be a natural outflow, or social justice should be a natural outflow of the gospel. We see it in the Old Testament, certainly, where Israel was commanded to have a concern for the foreigners, for aliens, because they too had once been foreigners and aliens. We see it, I think, in the Apostle Paul in his correspondence with Philemon, right? The slave owner. He's writing about Onesimus, the slave, who had come to Christ, and he's appealing with Philemon, the master, to receive him back, but to receive him back differently, not just as a slave, right, but as a brother. And so the gospel can't help but move us to the defense of the defenseless, right, to those who are oppressed. I think Livingston is a good reminder of that. Number three, we ought to view the entirety of our lives as service for Christ. This is the best quote from Livingston. I love this. My views of what is missionary duty are not so contracted as those whose ideal is a dumpy sort of man with a Bible under his arm. In other words, I have a bigger view, right? Not so contracted as that. I have labored in bricks and mortar at the forge and at the carpenter's bench, as well as in preaching and medical practice. I feel that I am not my own. I am serving Christ when shooting a buffalo for my men or taking an astronomical observation, right? Gauging things in the stars, right? I'm not my own. In other words, my whole life and every activity is God's. It's service for Christ. And I think there's something very, very powerful in that statement. In some ways, I think it is best to view Livingston not as a missionary, but as an explorer. So I think that's a good distinction to make, but it does not mean that his efforts were somehow unimportant, right? Number four, we're involved in something bigger than ourselves. Milbrandt suggests that Livingston passed away believing he failed in almost everything in his life. For abolition, he sacrificed his career, his reputation, his fortune, his wife, his children, eventually his own life. And perhaps the greatest publicity stunt the world had ever known, he went to his death for a cause in which he faithfully believed. He never saw the payoff. And I think that's so true of much of life, is it not? We don't always seeing Paul. That's part of the whole chapter in Hebrews 11, right? All of these people who lived by faith, and none of them received what they were hoping for. But that didn't mean it was in vain, right? The idea was that would ultimately come to fulfillment after their life, and that's a great worldview that we ought to have. That what we're involved in extends beyond us, it extends beyond our own earthly life. We're involved in something bigger. That ought to put fuel in our tank right there. Finally, Christians ought to be people of ambition. And to be honest, I don't even know how to express this. I think it's part of the critique of Livingston that he had some ambitions that actually I would say were out of line, to the detriment of his family and other responsibilities that God had given him. Having said that, we could do well to recover godly ambition in our day, right? You hear what I'm saying? There's something I think noble in his pursuit of a great goal.